Hi, I'm Seth Godin. I want you to steal this idea. Here's what you can do to spread the word about unleashing the idea virus. Go to www.ideavirus.com and download the Idea Virus Manifesto. That's the book this program is based on. Then send the file to a friend or send them a link to the site so they can download it themselves. You or they can also print out copies of Unleashing the Idea Virus. Print out as many as you like.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Unleashing the Idea Virus by Seth Godin, read by the author.
Here's the number one question people ask me after reading or listening to my book, Permission Marketing.
So how do we get attention to ask for permission in the first place?
This program is the answer to that question. Imagine for a second that you're at your business school reunion, trading lies and bragging about how successful you are and are about to become. Frank the jock talks about the dot-com company he just started. Susie, the ex-banker, is now focusing her energy on rebuilding Eastern Europe. And then the group looks at you. With a wry look of amusement, you answer, well, the future, the really big money, is in owning a farm, a small one, maybe 100 acres. I intend to invest in a tractor, of course, and expect that in just a few years, my husband and I can cash out and buy ourselves a nice little brownstone in the city. Ludicrous, no? While owning a farm may bring tremendous lifestyle benefits, it hasn't been a ticket to wealth for, say, 200 years. What about owning a factory, then? Perhaps the road to riches in the new economy would be to buy yourself a hot stamping press and start turning out steel widgets. Get the UAW to organize your small, dedicated staff of craftsmen, and you're on your way to robber baron status. Most of us can agree that the big money went out of owning a factory about 30 years ago. When you've got high fixed costs and you're competing against other folks who also know how to produce both quantity and quality, unseemly profits fly right out the window. Fact is, the first 100 years of our country's history were about who could build the biggest, most efficient farm. And the second century focused on the race to build factories. Welcome to the third century, folks. The third century is about ideas. Alas, nobody has a clue how to build a farm for ideas, or even a factory for ideas. We recognize that ideas are driving the economy, ideas are making people rich, and most important, ideas are changing the world. Even though we're clueless about how to best organize the production of ideas, one thing is clear. If you can get people to accept and embrace and adore and cherish your ideas, you win. You win financially, you gain power, and you change the world in which we live. So how do you win? What do you need to do to change the status quo of whatever industry you're in, or if you're lucky, to change the world? If you're a farmer, you want nothing more than a high price for your soybeans. If you're a manufacturer of consumer goods, you want a display at the cash register at Walmart. But what if you're an idea merchant? The holy grail for anyone who traffics in ideas is this, to unleash an idea virus. An idea that just sits there is worthless, but an idea that moves and grows and infects everyone it touches, that's an idea virus. In the old days, there was a limit on how many people you could feed with the corn from your farm or the widgets from your factory. But ideas not only replicate easily and well, they get more powerful and more valuable as you deliver them to more people. How does an idea virus manifest itself? Where does it live? What does it look like? It's useful to think of ideas of every sort as being similar. I call them manifestos. An idea manifesto is a powerful, logical essay that assembles a bunch of existing ideas and creates a new one. Sometimes a manifesto is a written essay, but it can be an image, a song, a cool product or process. The medium doesn't matter. The message does. By lumping all sorts of ideas, regardless of format, into the same category, manifestos, it's much easier to think of them as versions of the same thing. As long as you can use your manifesto to change the way people think, talk, or act, you can create value. Let's define medium. In order to move, an idea has to be encapsulated in a medium. It could be a picture, a phrase, a written article, a movie, even a mathematical formula like E equals MC squared. The medium used for transmitting the idea virus determines how smooth it is as well as the velocity of its growth. A medium is not a manifesto. Every idea is a manifesto trying to make its point, and the medium is the substance that the idea lives in. We live in a world where consumers actively resist marketing. So it's imperative to stop marketing at people. The idea is to create an environment where consumers will market to each other. Is an idea virus a form of marketing? Sure it is. And today, marketing is all there is. You don't win with better shipping or manufacturing or accounts payable. You win with better marketing, because marketing is about spreading ideas, and ideas are all you've got left to compete with. The future belongs to the people who unleash idea viruses. What's an idea virus? It's a big idea that runs amok across the target audience. It's a fashionable idea that propagates through a section of the population, teaching and changing and influencing everyone it touches. And in our rapidly changing world, the art and science of building, launching, and profiting from idea viruses is the next frontier. Have you ever heard of Hotmail? Ever used it? If so, it's not because Hotmail ran a lot of TV ads. They didn't. It's because the manifesto of free email got to you. It turned into an idea virus. Someone you know and trust infected you with it. What about a Polaroid camera? Was your first exposure, no pun intended, in a TV ad? Or did you discover it when a friend showed you how cool the idea of an instant photograph was? Sometimes it seems like everyone is watching the same TV show as you, or reading the same book, or talking about the same movie or website. How does that happen? It usually occurs because the idea spreads on its own, through an accidental idea virus, not because the company behind the product spent a ton of money advertising it or a lot of time orchestrating a virus. And how the idea spreads, and how to make it spread faster, that's the idea behind unleashing an idea virus. Word of mouth is not new. It's just different now. There were always idea viruses, gossip or ideas or politics that spread like wildfire from person to person. Without running an ad or buying a billboard, Galileo managed to upset all of Pisa with his ideas. Today, though, idea viruses are more important and more powerful than ever. Idea viruses are easier to launch and more effective. Idea viruses are critical because they're fast, and speed wins and speed kills. Brands and products just don't have the time to develop the old way. Idea viruses give us increasing returns. Word of mouth dies out, but idea viruses get bigger. And finally, idea viruses are the currency of the future. While idea viruses aren't new, they are important because we're obsessed with the new, and an idea virus is always about the new. It took 40 years for radio to have 10 million users. By then, an industry had grown that could profit from the mass audience. It took 15 years for TV to have 10 million users. It only took 3 years for Netscape to get to 10 million, and it took Hotmail and Napster less than a year. By aggregating mass audiences to themselves and not having to share them with an entire industry, companies like Netscape and Hotmail are able to realize huge profits seemingly overnight, and they do it by spreading idea viruses. Ideas can now be carried in the ether. Because the medium for carrying ideas is fast and cheap, ideas move faster and cheaper. Whether it's the image of the new VW Beetle, how long did it take for the idea of that car to find a place in your brain, or the words of a new Stephen King novel, more than 100,000 people read it the first week it was available online, the time it takes for an idea to circulate is approaching zero. Why should we care? Why does it matter that ideas can instantly cross international boundaries, change discussions about politics, crime, and justice, or even get us to buy something? Because the currency of our future is ideas, and the idea virus mechanism is the way those ideas propagate. And the science and art of creating idea viruses and using them for profit is new and powerful. You don't have to wait for an idea virus to happen organically or accidentally. You can plan for it and optimize for it and make it happen. In the old days, the way we sold a product was through interruption marketing. We'd run ads, interrupt people with unanticipated, impersonal, irrelevant ads, and hope that they'd buy something. And sometimes it worked. The advantage of this branding strategy is that the marketer is in complete and total control. The disadvantage is that it's hard and expensive. Every time a catalog clothier, Lands End, Eddie Bauer, you name it, wants to sign up a new customer, they need to buy a few hundred stamps, send out some carefully designed catalogs, and hope that one person sends them money. What marketers are searching for is a way to circumvent the tyranny of cost per thousand interruptions. They need something that ignites, a way to tap into the invisible currents that run between and among consumers, and they need to help those currents move in better, faster, and more profitable ways. Instead of always talking to consumers, they have to help consumers talk to each other. A beautifully executed commercial on the Super Bowl is an extraordinarily risky bet. Building a flashy and snazzy website is almost certain to lead to failure. Hiring a celebrity spokesperson might work on occasion, but more often than not, it won't break through the clutter. Whenever advertisers build their business around the strategy of talking directly to the customer, they become slaves to the math of interruption marketing. Fortunately, there are already proven techniques you can use to identify, launch, and profit from ideas that can be turned into idea viruses. There's a right and a wrong way to create them, and more important, the care and feeding of your idea virus can dramatically affect its potency. One of the key elements in launching an idea virus is concentrating the message. If just 1% or even 15% of a group is excited about your idea, it's not enough. You only win when you totally dominate and amaze the group you've targeted. That's why focusing obsessively on a geographic or demographic or psychographic group is a common trait among successful idea merchants. Why are new companies launching on the net so obsessed with traffic and visitors? Why is a company like GeoCities sold for more than $2 billion when it has close to zero revenue and interesting, but by no means unique, software? Because infecting large populations with the idea virus is the first step to building a profitable business model. The key steps for internet companies looking to build a virus are: 1. Create a noteworthy online experience that's either totally new or makes the user's life much better. Or make an offline experience better, faster, cheaper, so that switching is worth the hassle. 2. Have the idea behind your online experience go viral, bringing you a large chunk of the group you're targeting without having to spend a fortune advertising the new service. 3. Fill the vacuum in the marketplace with your version of the idea, so that competitors now have a very difficult time of unteaching your virus and starting their own. 4. Achieve lock-in by creating larger and larger costs of switching from your service to someone else's. 5. Get permission from users to maintain an ongoing dialogue so that you can turn the original attention into a beneficial experience for users and an ongoing profit stream for you. 6. Continue creating noteworthy online experiences to further spread new viruses, starting with your core audience of raving fans. Quick! Name an oil painting hanging in a museum somewhere in the world. Did you say the Mona Lisa? As I walk through the Louvre, arguably one of the 10 most packed with high-quality paintings museums on the planet, I pass one empty room after another, then come to an alcove packed with people. Why? Why are these people clawing all over each other in order to see a painting poorly displayed behind many inches of bulletproof glass? The reason the Mona Lisa is the most famous painting in the world is that something had to be the most famous painting in the world, and it might as well be the Mona Lisa. Busy people don't have time to look at every painting. They only have room in their overcrowded, media-hyped brains for a few paintings. And when you come right down to it, most people would like to see only the celebrity paintings. And just as there can only be one, my favorite movie actress, Julia Roberts, and one, this site equals the internet, Yahoo, there's only room for one most famous painting in the world, and the safe choice is the Mona Lisa. There's a name for this effect. It's called Zipf's Law, after George Zipf, 1902 to 1950, a philologist and professor at Harvard University. He discovered that the most popular word in the English language, the, is used 10 times more than the 10th most popular word, 100 times more than the 100th most popular word, and 1,000 times more than the 1,000th most popular word. It's also been discovered that this same effect applies to market share for software, soft drinks, cars, candy bars, and the frequency of hits on pages found on a website. In almost every field of endeavor, it's clear that being number one is a lot better than being number 3 or number 10. There isn't an even distribution of rewards, especially in our networked world. On the net, the stakes are even larger. The market cap of Priceline, eBay, and Amazon approaches 95% of the total market cap of every consumer e-commerce stock combined. Clearly, there's a lot to be gained by winning. An idea virus lets you make something like this happen to your idea, to your business, to your product. While the benefits of being number one for a public internet stock or an oil painting are clear, it's just as important to small businesses and individuals. Idea viruses are faced with a brick wall filter. In electronics, a brick wall filter wipes out certain frequencies and lets the rest through. There's no room for second place or extra effort. Either you're in or you're out. Idea viruses are win-lose propositions. Either the velocity and smoothness are high enough that it becomes a bona fide epidemic, or they're not, and it dies out. Either your idea virus works or it doesn't. Smart propagators know when to quit if their idea virus isn't getting through the filter. Let's define velocity. The velocity is a measure of how fast the idea spreads from one party to another. If an idea is going to hit 10 people before it gets to me, the multiplier effect is large indeed. Fast steps lead to more people being infected before it dies out. Let's define smoothness. How easy is it for an end user to spread this particular idea virus? Can I click one button or mention some magic phrase, or do I have to go through hoops and risk embarrassment to tell someone about it? The smoothest viruses, like Hotmail, spread themselves. Just the act of using the product spreads the virus. There's an obvious relationship between smoothness and catchiness. A product that's easy to recommend is often a product that's easy to get hooked on. Here are some astonishing facts you should think about long and hard on your way to work tomorrow. 20 years ago, the top 100 companies in the Fortune 500 either dug something out of the ground or turned a natural resource like iron ore or oil into something you could hold. Today, fewer than half of the companies on the list do that. The rest make unseemly profits by trafficking in ideas. In 1998, there were 30,000 new musical CDs published, including one from the Pope. His, which I like a lot, features a little rap, a little techno, and a lot of world beat. 99% of Yahoo's market cap is due to brand, sizzle, user loyalty, and other soft ideas. Only 1% of the company's value is due to actual unique stuff that you can't get anywhere else. Nathan Myhrvold, former chief scientist at Microsoft, says a great programmer is worth 10,000 times more than an average one. Why? Because of the quality of her ideas. The important takeaway is this: ideas aren't a sideshow that make a factory a little more valuable. A factory is a sideshow that makes our ideas a little more valuable. Okay, let's move on. People are more connected than they ever were before. We have dramatically more friends of friends, and we can connect with them faster and more frequently than ever. Think back, really far, 10 years ago. How many people did you have regular telephone contact with 10 years ago? Probably 10 or 20 or 30 in your personal life, and maybe 100 at work. Now, take a look at your email box and your ICQ buddy list. How many people do you hear from every week? We're far more connected than we ever were. And now, we've got second or third or fourth order connections. There's an email in my box from someone who is married to someone I went to summer camp with 20 years ago who got my email address from a third friend. Another message is from a former employee telling me about a doctor who's about to lose his license for trying radical medical treatments and how her mother-in-law will suffer if this guy can't practice any longer. It's hard for me to imagine either person contacting me if they had to walk across the village and bang on the door of my hut or pick up the phone and call me. But the moment you connect to the internet, you connect, at some level, to all of us. And the connections make ideas travel fast. What's the difference between word of mouth and an idea virus? Two differences. First, word of mouth tends to spread slower. Be more analog. If you like a book, you might tell a friend or two. and then your friends are unlikely to tell someone else until they read it for themselves. Second, word of mouth dies off. Because the numbers are smaller, it doesn't take many people who don't participate in the word of mouth for each generation to be smaller than the one before it. Traditional advertising is a game with winners and losers. If your product gets attention from the targeted consumer, you win mind share and your customer loses time. When a consumer is foolish enough to listen to an irrelevant ad, she loses time and doesn't even gain useful information. It's an old economy model in which every transaction has someone taking something. Permission marketing and the idea virus are both very different from this model. These models create a game in which everyone can win. If there's a great idea and it moves through the hive for free, everyone who touches it wins in several ways. First, you as the consumer win for recommending it to a friend. This increases your status as a powerful sneezer or your compensation as a promiscuous sneezer. Because you respect your peers, you're not suggesting or pitching something that doesn't make your friends' lives better. Violate this respect and your power as a sneezer goes way down. Let's define sneezer. Some people are more likely to tell their friends about a great new idea. These people are at the heart of the idea virus. Identifying and courting sneezers is a key success factor for idea merchants. Second, the recipient benefits as well. He benefits from the way the idea changes his life, and he benefits because he now has the ability to sneeze the idea to someone else, thus increasing his power. Third, the creator of the idea succeeds because her idea propagates and because she can sell souvenirs, speeches, consulting, value-added services, to people who are now open and receptive to her idea. My friend Chris Meyer, co-author of Blur, had this to say. The one thing that distinguishes effective sneezing campaigns from ineffective ones is respect for the time, attention, and reputation of the next guy to catch the virus. It's important to note that the decision to sneeze is, in general, a distributed one, made by each of us as to whether to clog our friend's email or whatever with the virus in question, because our reputation is at stake. This insight goes to the core of why idea viruses are succeeding and why traditional marketers don't immediately grasp this approach, or permission marketing for that matter. The distributed nature of the decision is the antithesis of the command and control general patent approach that marketers have taken previously. The reason that the Red Herring, the industry standard, and other magazines are jammed with ads is not because the ads always work. They don't. The reason the ads are purchased is that in exchange for money, the marketer gets the illusion that they're in charge of the conversation, at least for a few seconds. Bill Birnbach, the dean of American advertising, was co-founder of DDB Advertising. He died 20 years ago, but before he left us, he pointed the way to this new way of marketing. He said, "You cannot sell a man who isn't listening. Word of mouth is the best medium of all, and dullness won't sell your product, but neither will irrelevant brilliance." The answer, of course, is to give people a reason to listen and then create an infrastructure that will amplify their ability to spread word of mouth. And core to both of those tasks is the new respect that marketers need to show newly powerful consumers. Let's go on. While it may appear accidental, it's possible to dramatically increase the chances your idea virus will catch on and spread. Here comes the really cool part. Once you understand the fundamental elements behind the propagation of an idea virus, you can unleash your own. Just because idea viruses have usually spread through unknown means or accidental events doesn't mean that there isn't a science to building and managing them. You can invest in designing your product to make it virus-worthy. Then, if you understand the 8 elements of the idea virus formula, you can increase your chances of spreading your idea virus with every step along the way. This can change the way you approach all of your marketing. If launching an idea virus is the most powerful thing you can do for a product and service, and there are steps you can take to increase the likelihood that this will occur. You've got to try. At the heart of the idea virus are sneezers. You just heard the definition of the term. Let's explore it further. Some people are far more likely to spread an idea virus than others. Malcolm Gladwell, author of the brilliant book An Idea Virus, The Tipping Point, calls this the law of the few and breaks the key virus spreaders into three groups: connectors, mavens, and salespeople. What's critical in the analysis is understanding that some folks are dead ends, while others will enable and amplify your idea virus. In his best example, Gladwell talks about the success of Paul Revere in warning us that the British are coming. It turns out that a second man, William Dawes, went on a similar ride the same night, but his was a total failure. Why did Dawes fail where Revere succeeded? It's because people knew Paul Revere. They trusted him. He had credibility. And so when he said something, people were willing to listen and believe. Revere was a sneezer. Dawes, a loner, tried hard, but couldn't get the idea to become a virus. Sneezers are at the core of any idea virus. Sneezers are the ones who, when they tell 10 or 20 or 100 people, people believe them. There are two basic kinds of sneezers: promiscuous sneezers and powerful sneezers. What's a promiscuous sneezer? This is your uncle, the insurance salesman. These are members of a hive who can be counted on to try to sell their favorite idea virus to almost anyone, almost any time. Promiscuous sneezers can be motivated by money or other inducements. Promiscuous sneezers are rarely held in high esteem as opinion leaders, but if they're promiscuous enough, they can be extremely effective. Let's define hive. People are not one amorphous mass. We're self-organized into groups, or hives, that have several things in common: a way to communicate among ourselves, spoken or unspoken rules and standards, a common history, fashion leaders. Some examples? Fraternity brothers at a college, Orthodox Jews, readers of Fast Company, deadheads. Many of the net businesses that are now being organized around idea viruses are targeting promiscuous sneezers. Companies like Mercata, All Advantage, and even Amazon are offering inducements to customers that compensate them for spreading ideas to their friends and acquaintances in an attempt to acquire new customers. As the value of creating idea viruses increases, we'll see more of this, and we'll also see more and more people becoming promiscuous sneezers. Basically, we're paying folks enough to corrupt them into spreading ideas in exchange for cash. The second type of sneezers are powerful sneezers. The hat business is near the end of an 80-year downward spiral to total irrelevance. Each year has brought worse news, with one manufacturer after another going out of business, and most towns left with one, if they're lucky, haberdasher. In the midst of all this dismal news, about 20 years ago there was one bright spot: Harrison Ford, with a bullwhip, wearing a hat. Indiana Jones sold more hats for Stetson than any single person since the invention of the Marlboro Man. Why? Because Ford has the influence to set style. Because his appearance in a movie wearing that hat coaxed millions of men who wanted to be like him into buying a hat. The paradox of the powerful sneezer is that he can't be bought. Every time a powerful sneezer accepts a bribe in exchange for spreading a virus, his power decreases. When Bruce Springsteen does ads in Japan, or Whoopi Goldberg shills for flus, they have less leverage as powerful sneezers. The public knows that they can be motivated by more than just taste. In fact, every time a powerful sneezer tries something new and introduces a new idea, she takes a risk. If her followers reject the virus for whatever reason, her ability to introduce future viruses decreases. For this reason, it's difficult to manipulate powerful sneezers, and equally difficult to predict what might motivate them to adopt an idea virus. As the net makes it easier to measure idea viruses and motivate sneezers, we're going to see far more people become promiscuous sneezers, but at the same time, the role of powerful sneezer will become ever more important. As available attention becomes ever more precious, we're going to be far more likely to listen to someone who's spreading a virus for non-personal gain. Epinions.com is a fascinating model of the intersection between the powerful and the promiscuous sneezers. Here's a site where hundreds of thousands of people come to hear the opinions of thousands of sneezers. Everything is reviewed from books to dishwashers, and the reviewers are clearly identified and constantly ranked. Promiscuous sneezers suddenly become powerful. How? If a lot of people read and like your reviews carry more weight, regardless of your compensation scheme. XYZ has posted more than 1,000 reviews and been read more than 100,000 times. She's compensated every time someone reads one of her reviews, so she certainly qualifies as promiscuous. She works hard to get others to read her reviews, but at the same time, she's developing a reputation as a powerful sneezer. So, how do you attract and keep promiscuous sneezers? There are 6 key principles. 1. Make big promises. 2. Show them how to make it up in volume. 3. Describe an attainable path to success. 4. When someone succeeds, tell the rest of them. 5. Give the successful ones a way to show the non-sneezers it worked. And 6. Have a Mary Kay convention. Let's look briefly at each of these. First, make big promises. One of the things that drives someone to become a promiscuous sneezer is the opportunity for a change in lifestyle. Certain rewards, though small, are not as enticing as slightly less certain rewards that are much larger. Human nature, especially among optimists, will give you the benefit of the doubt on the risks, but it won't cut you any slack on the rewards. So I'm much more likely to help you out for a chance to get free dry cleaning for 6 months than I am to get a certain reward of $4 off my next dry cleaning bill. Next, show them how to make it up in volume. Of course, the promise has to be believable. One of the best ways to do that is to make it clear to the promiscuous sneezer that the system can be gamed, that if they work the system, the odds of winning go way up. If I look at the offer you make and say, wait, if I go to 10 friends, not just one, then I'm a lock to win this great prize, you've done it just right. I may think I'm scamming you by going to so many people to adjust the odds in my favor, but actually I'm doing just what you wanted me to do, and then some. Many of the online affiliate programs work this way. These programs offer a commission for referrals that result in a sale. First designed as a cheap way to get new customers referred from relevant websites, they've evolved into something far bigger. If you're at an online pet store, for example, and you see a link to a book about training dogs, you can click on the link and buy it from Amazon.com. Amazon then sends the affiliate, the online pet store, a commission. Small business people have looked at these programs and said, wait, if I build a site that does nothing but sell books and Barnes & Noble does all the work, I'll scam the system and make a lot of money. Of course, the online bookstore doesn't care a whit about where the customers come from. They're just happy to have them. In essence, hundreds of thousands of entrepreneurs are now building businesses dedicated to finding customers for other merchants. Third, describe an attainable path. Alas, trust is in short supply, even among optimistic, promiscuous sneezers. Thus, you've got to make it clear to potential sneezers that there is, in fact, a way for them to profit from this adventure. This is especially true for offers where you don't have a lot of time to make your case. By showing the sneezer how smooth the system is, by making it trivially easy to forward that email or whisper to that friend, you're far more likely to get their initial enthusiasm. The first few sneezes are the most difficult to get an individual to perform. Fourth, when someone succeeds, tell the rest of them. This is so important and so overlooked. I'm presuming that you've gained permission to talk with your sneezers on an ongoing basis. So now talk to them. I'm a member of several online affiliate programs, and not one of them does this. Why not send announcements detailing how the most effective affiliates are doing? Why not invite me to visit their sites and see them in action? by making it really clear that some sneezers are happily profiting, you dramatically increase the chances you'll get better performance from the rest of your sneezers. Fifth, give the successful ones a way to show the non-sneezers it worked. Mary Kay Cosmetics gives its best people a pink Cadillac. This is no accident. There are plenty of ways to pay off a promiscuous sneezer. Why do it with a pink Cadillac? Because it is a persistent amplifier of this sneezer's success. Because it attracts new sneezers to the fold. Because it's proof to the rest of your organization and to the world that you can get rich by selling cosmetics to your friends. And finally, have a sales convention. Just because it's a new century doesn't mean we should abandon the idea of getting together in real life. Zig Ziglar tells the story of how Mary Kay went to a sales convention when she was a struggling salesperson. She didn't even have enough money to eat the meals there. She brought her own crackers and cheese. But at the final banquet, when the salespeople queued up to shake the company president's hand, Mary Kay looked at him and said, "Next year, I'll be back as the number one salesperson." The president, who could have easily brushed off the claim, stopped what he was doing, paused for a full 30 seconds, looked her in the eye and said, "Yes, yes, I believe you will." And the rest is sales history. But without the convention, I seriously doubt this would have occurred. How can you get together with your best promiscuous sneezers? Marketers have been pursuing word of mouth for years. There are five important principles that someone unleashing an idea virus should understand. Principles that marketers pursuing old-fashioned word-of-mouth didn't use. 1. An idea merchant understands that creating the virus is the single most important part of her job. So she'll spend all her time and money creating a product and environment that feeds the virus. 2. An idea merchant understands that by manipulating the key elements of idea propagation, the velocity, the vector, the smoothness, the persistence, and the identification of sneezers, she can dramatically alter a virus's success. Let's define persistence. Some ideas stick around a long time with each person, influencing them and those they sneeze on for months or years to come. Others have a much shorter half-life before they fade out. Let's define vector. As an idea virus moves through a population, it usually follows a vector. It could be a movement toward a certain geographic or demographic audience, for example. Sometimes, an idea virus starts in a subgroup and then breaks through that niche into the public consciousness. Other times, it works its way through a group and then just stops. Napster vectored straight to college kids. Why? Because they combined the three things necessary for the virus to catch on: a fast internet connection, lots of spare time, and an obsession with new music. 3. The idea merchant remembers that digital word of mouth is a permanent written record online, a legacy that will follow the product, for good or for bad, forever. 4. An idea merchant realizes that the primary goal of a product or service is not just to satisfy the needs of one user. It has to deliver so much wow, be so cool, so neat, and so productive that the user tells five friends. Products market themselves by creating and reinforcing idea viruses. 5. An idea merchant knows that the idea virus follows a life cycle, and he decides at which moment to shift from paying to spread it to charging the user and profiting from it. Let's move on. Once it does spread, an idea virus follows a life cycle. Ignore the life cycle and the idea virus dies out. Feed it properly and you can ride it for a long time. Tom Peters co-wrote In Search of Excellence nearly 20 years ago. Through some smart marketing moves, not to mention a great virus, the book became an epidemic and turned into the best-selling business book ever written. Tom's career could have followed the arc of almost every other business writer. A big hit, followed by a long decline into obscurity. But instead of ignoring the life cycle, Tom insists on riding it, and he's still riding it today. Every few years, he unleashes a new idea virus. He writes mind-blowing articles, like the Brand Called You cover piece for Fast Company a few years ago, and follows up with books and exhausting worldwide speaking tours. When he shows up in a town to give a speech, perhaps a third of the people there are dyed-in-the-wool Tom Peters fans. And the rest of the audience, brought there by the fans, exposed to his virus, ready to be turned into fans. By leveraging the base that his first book brought him, Tom has built a career out of launching new idea viruses. Sure, none of them were as big as In Search of Excellence, but the vacuum keeps getting smaller, so the opportunities are smaller. Other companies and ideas have ridden their first wave and then disappeared. People no longer clamor to dance the hustle or get into Studio 54. They don't visit the once-hot Jenny Cam website or pay a premium for front-row seats at Katz. Why? Because instead of institutionalizing the process of improving, honing, and launching new idea viruses to replace the dying ones, the owners of these viruses milked them until they died. Let's move on. Viral marketing is an idea virus, but not all idea viruses are viral marketing. Viral marketing is a special case of an idea virus. Viral marketing is an idea virus in which the medium of the virus is the product. It's an idea where the idea is the amplifier. Let's define amplifier. A key difference between word of mouth and an idea virus is that word of mouth dies out while an idea virus gets bigger. Why is that? Because something amplifies the recommendations to a far larger audience. That could be TV or other forms of media. A good review in the New York Times that amplifies the message of one reviewer to many readers is a great example. Or it could be the web. A site like planetfeedback.com amplifies the message of a single user to a large audience. Steve Jurvetson, the venture capitalist behind Hotmail, coined the term viral marketing to describe the way the service grew. Hotmail offered free email. That alone was a very compelling two-word business proposition. But the magic of the company was that in every single email you sent using the service, there was a little ad on the bottom of the note, and the ad said, "Get your private free email from Hotmail at www.hotmail.com. Every time you send a note, you spread the virus. The magic of viral marketing is that the medium carries the message. The more you use Hotmail, the more you spread the virus. But note, it was also extremely smooth. The Hotmail site was just a click away from an email, and it took just a few clicks more to start using it and sending Hotmail's built-in ads to your friends. Unfortunately, not every product lends itself to viral marketing. Viral marketing requires that the product you're using be communications-focused or very public. The new VW Beetle is an example of viral marketing. Why? Because the more you drive it, the more people see it. And the more Beetles people see, the more they want one. It's not audible, and it's not as smooth as Hotmail, but it is most definitely viral. Many of the very best internet ideas are built around some level of viral marketing. Referrals.com pays big money to people who recruit their friends for hot jobs. Of course, the act of recruiting your friends is also the act of telling them about referrals.com. Please try not to get too obsessed with the magic, self-referencing nature of viral marketing companies. They're a very special case. For example, it's hard to imagine how most books could use viral marketing. Interesting, though, that line dances like The Hustle and the Macarena did use viral marketing. After all, you can't do the dance unless you teach your friends how. Let's move on. What does it take to build and spread an idea virus? There are two questions you can ask yourself about your idea before you launch it. Questions that will help you determine how likely it is that your idea will become an idea virus. Is it worth it? Nobody spreads an idea virus as a favor to you. They do it because it's remarkable, thought-provoking, important, profitable, funny, horrible, or beautiful. In today's winner-take-all world, there's no room for a me-too offering, or worse, boring products or services. If it's not compelling, it will never lead to an idea virus. Face it, Nobody's going to hand out big rewards ever again for being on time, performing work of good quality, being useful, finishing a project on budget, or being good enough. That's expected. That's a given. The rewards and the idea viruses belong to the first, the fastest, the coolest, the very best. The biggest mistake companies make is that they chicken out. If your idea doesn't become a virus, it's most likely because it didn't deserve to become a virus. If you're now defining yourself as an idea merchant, hey, it's either that or lose, then you must accept the fact that being brave and bold in the creation of ideas is the only reason you went to work today. Second question, is it smooth? After someone's been exposed to an idea virus just once, they're not likely to actually catch it. We've made our brains bulletproof and idea-proof. There's so much clutter, so much noise, so many ideas to choose from, that the vast majority of them fail to make a dent. Think about the last time you walked through a bookstore. The home of idea viruses just waiting to happen. How many books did you stop and look at, pick up, turn over? And how many of those books ended up in your shopping basket, got read, led you to tell 10 friends? Precious few, that's for sure. Compare this to the Harry Potter phenomenon, the best-selling books of the last few years created just because kids told kids. A classic idea virus, and one that initially grew with no promotion at all from the publisher. It's difficult to get from awareness to the sale of an idea. It's difficult to convert a stranger into a friend, and harder still to convert a friend into a carrier of your idea virus. An idea virus succeeds when it pierces our natural defenses and makes an impact. In Greek mythology, they tell the story of the Medusa. The Medusa was part of the race of Gorgons, beings with a horrible curse. Anyone who looked in their eyes immediately and permanently turned to stone. There are plenty of marketers who wished that their ads or their product had the power of the Medusa, that every person who saw it would be immediately transfixed, rooted to the spot, and converted into a customer for life. Of course, they don't want their customers to die a horrible death and be turned into stone, but I couldn't find a Greek myth in which an evil goddess turned you into a frequent shopper of Kate Spade purses, getting a second mortgage just to pay for them. Alas, there are precious few Gorgon products, and even fewer ad campaigns with Gorgon-like properties. It's foolish to expect that one exposure to your message will instantly convert someone from stranger to raving idea virus spreading fan. So plan on a process. Plan on a method that takes people from where they are to where you want them to go. And while you're at it, work on the product, because a catchier, more compelling, more viral product makes your job 100 times easier. These are critical decisions because of the attention deficit that marketers are facing. In 1986, the year I published my first book, there were about 300 other business books published. In 1998, there were 1,778 business books brought to market. The supermarket sees about 15,000 new products introduced every year. The Levenger catalog alone features more than 50 different pens and pencils, none of which were available just a couple years ago. There isn't a marketplace out there that isn't more crowded than it was a decade ago. In a world where products are screaming for attention, the most precious commodity is attention. And attention is harder and harder to achieve. If you already understand the power of permission, your next question might be, fine, but how do we get permission? How do we get the first date, the first interaction where we ask people if we can start an ongoing dialogue about our products and their needs? My answer used to be a rather weak mumble about buying ads. The right answer, however, is to create an idea virus. The right answer is to let the market tell itself about your products and services and give you permission to continue the dialogue without you having to pay for it each time. The right answer is to create products so dynamic and virus-worthy that you earn the attention. Let's move on. There are three key levers that determine how your idea virus will spread. 1. How big do you launch? 2. how smooth is it? 3, how can you turn trial into persistence? Let's look at the first one. How many people know about it before the spreading starts? You can launch big or you can launch small. Vindigo, a viral phenomenon discussed in more detail later, launched their Palm Idea Virus with just 100 people. Within weeks, that number had grown to 3,000, and then quickly to more than 100,000, all without advertising. However, if you're entering a vacuum and there's plenty of competition on the horizon, launching big, while more expensive, can increase the chances that you'll succeed. How to launch big? With traditional interruption advertising, with sponsorships, with free samples. One of the dumbest things marketers do is put artificial barriers in the way of trial. For example, it's obvious that one of the best ways to kill sales of a new car is to charge people $100 just to take a test drive. But charging for a test drive is just as dumb as a politician charging people to hear a speech, or a movie studio charging for the coming attractions. When you launch an idea virus, the more people who can see it fast, the faster it will spread. 2, the importance of smoothness. In addition to being persistent and cool, an idea virus spreads the fastest when it's smooth. Persistence matters because the longer people are sneezing about your idea, the more people they infect. Cool is critical because if it's not virus-worthy, it's just not going to take off. But smooth is essential because if you can make it easy for the virus to spread, it's more likely to do so. In viral marketing, for products like the Polaroid camera and Ophoto.com, the ideal solution is to build smooth transference tools right into the idea, which can be difficult. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. Amazon tried with Member Get a Member promotions, in which they bribe members to tell their friends to buy books from Amazon. Get $5 for your friends and $5 for you. ZDNet puts a button next to every story they publish on their website. Click here to send this article to a friend. Smooth. Tupperware built an entire company around the smooth transfer of product enthusiasm from one friend to another. When you have a Tupperware party, you are simultaneously hanging out with friends, demonstrating products you like, selling them, and recruiting other people to do the same to their friends. By focusing obsessively on how to make it smooth, you can dramatically increase the velocity of the idea virus. 3, turning trial into persistence. Sooner or later, you've got to turn momentary attention into an embrace of your idea, and then hopefully into conversion of the user into a sneezer. Permission marketing becomes a critical tool in working people through this transition. The Hare Krishnas have grown their sect by inviting people to eat a vegetarian dinner with them. Intrigued or just hungry, people give them momentary attention and then permission to talk to them about this new way of life. Sometimes people leave, having done nothing but eaten dinner. Sometimes people listen to what's being said and decide to embrace the ideals being discussed. And sometimes they become converted and turn into sneezers, volunteering to go out and invite other people over for dinner the next night. Note that the Hare Krishnas didn't start by walking up to a stranger and proselytizing about their religion. Instead, they used a gradual technique to sell their idea effectively and turn it into a virus. Are there religions that are not viruses? Sure. The Shakers were. They didn't try to convert at all. And that's why there are no Shakers left. On the web, this multi-step process is too often overlooked by companies facing short-term financial pressure. Combine this with the legendary short attention span of entrepreneurs, and you can see why this happens. Instead of building a virus-worthy cool product or service, identifying a hive, promoting an idea, and making it smooth and persistent, they just spend a few million dollars to buy some advertising. The hope, of course, is that somehow, by spending enough money on clever ads, they'll magically create the critical mass of positive energy that will turn their idea into a virus. They're looking for a shortcut, and as a result, leading their companies to doom. Building a virus takes insight, talent, and most of all, patience. After a consumer is interested enough to visit ZDNet or Google.com or some other neat new site, what should these sites do to augment the idea virus? Three things. One, get permission to follow up. Make it easy for me to learn about why I should embrace this idea over time. All those ads you ran are a great way to get someone to your site, but it might cost your site $100 in marketing expenditures to get that one visit from just one consumer. If you don't get permission to follow up, the entire $100 is wasted. Two, make as many supporting manifestos available as possible in whatever forms necessary to turn consumers from skeptics into converts. This can include endorsements, press reviews, even criticisms and commonly made objections. Think of the Hare Krishnas at dinner. The more they can expose you to during that hour, the better the odds of spreading the virus. Three, make it easy for consumers to spread the idea virus by providing a multitude of telefriend tools, as well as overt rewards for becoming a sneezer. Let's move on. Here are five ways to unleash an idea virus. The most important element these five ways share is that for best results, you must build in the thinking from the very beginning. If you've got an existing product or service and you're hoping to build a virus around it, your job will be much more difficult. The ideas behind the lightning-fast success stories have all worked because the idea virus concept was baked in from the start. That's one of the reasons more established companies are having so much trouble competing in the new economy. They're restricted because of the standards and systems they built in years ago. The five techniques, in order of sheer market power, are 1. Go full viral. The more it's used, the more it's marketed, whether you want to or not. In essence, using the product is the same as marketing it. 2. Pay off the promiscuous. 3. Make it smooth for the powerful. 4. Digitally augment word of mouth. And 5. Altruism. Reward the friends of the promiscuous. Let's talk about 1, going full viral. This is the holy grail of idea virus marketing. The beauty of viral marketing is that if you properly construct the virus, you can grow like a weed and dominate the market, if you can do it before the competition. Blue Mountain Arts was a pioneer in creating a virus around the idea of sending electronic greeting cards. The virus is simple to understand. In order to send a greeting card successfully, you've got to send it to someone. Of course, once someone receives the card, if they like the idea, they're just a click away from sending someone else a card. Even though the cards featured by Blue Mountain Arts could charitably be called cheesy, the virus caught on. People got the idea that it might be fun to send electronic cards to their friends, and the idea spread. The company started small, with no real advertising. Just a few people sent the first batch of cards. But then the magic of viral marketing kicked in. Let's assume that each person sends cards to 5 people. Let's also assume that those recipients have a 50% chance of being interested enough in the concept to go to the site and send cards to 5 of their friends. If we start with 10 people, the generations look like this. 10 people send 50 cards, which means that 25 people get the virus and send 125 cards, which means that 63 people get the virus and send 315 cards, which means 162 people get the virus and send 810 cards, which means that 405 people get the virus and send 2,025 cards. Now, that may seem like a slow start, but if you assume that each generation takes 3 days to occur, I send out 10 cards and within 3 days, 5 friends show up and do the same thing, then you'd have 58 million users in just 54 days. Of course, that doesn't really happen. It's unlikely you'll be able to continue to get a 50% conversion rate. And it's certain that you'll soon hit duplication, with individuals starting to get cards from different people. But the math is nevertheless stunning. The key number in the equation is the percentage of people who convert. If you lower it from 50% in the Blue Mountain Arts example to 30%, the number of users drops from 58 million to less than 10,000. which is why conversion is so critical. By focusing on smoothness, it's only 3 clicks to send a card, and it's free, so go ahead and try it. Blue Mountain built an amazing conversion machine. As a result, the site grew and grew until Excite bought it for nearly $1 billion. Whatever Blue Mountain's goal, to make a lot of money, to affect a lot of people, or to spread their idea far and wide, they've succeeded. 2. Pay off the promiscuous. Paying powerful sneezers in an effort to make them promiscuous, but have them keep the power, is an extremely difficult balancing act. But if you can do it successfully, you can turn it into a $1 billion business. Some people call it network marketing or multi-level marketing. Others think of it as a paid celebrity endorsement. But it can be as simple as member get a member for your local health club. The basic idea is simple. If your recommendation is going to help my business, I'm happy to pay you to recommend me. The implementations vary all over the map. When Nike paid the coach of the Duke University basketball team millions of dollars for him, not for Duke, to coerce his team members to switch to Nike shoes, they were turning a formerly powerful sneezer into a promiscuous one. Why? When people see what the Blue Devils wear, they might decide to wear the same thing. On the net, technology makes it easy to take this model and make it much more personal. Amazon's affiliate program, in which Amazon pays users a portion of the book revenue they generate through referrals, is built around this model. Go to www.permission.com. There, at the bottom of the page, is a link where you can buy a copy of Permission Marketing. Click on it, and it will take you to Barnes & Noble or Amazon, right to the page on the site that sells Permission Marketing. Both stores give me a kickback on every sale. Did I send you to Amazon just because I'm going to get a kickback? Nope. It doesn't do me any good to recommend a bookseller where you won't end up buying the book. I'll end up with no kickback and no book sales either. I recommended Amazon because you're likely to have one-click shopping already set up, increasing the chances the book will get sold. I also recommended Barnes & Noble because their affiliate program is at least as good, and some of my customers would prefer to shop there. But the kickback still influenced my decision and has clearly motivated hundreds of thousands of individuals and businesses to set up links to their favorite books at Amazon and at Barnes & Noble. This approach is far less risky than Nike's. Nike has no idea if the Blue Devils actually sell shoes. They also have to pay for the endorsement in advance, with no refunds if they're wrong. Amazon and other affiliate marketers, on the other hand, are using the power of the net to create a deal with no losers and no downside. You can set up an affiliate link in a few minutes, for free. If it works, you get paid. If it doesn't work, you don't. And it doesn't cost Amazon a dime. 3. Make it smooth for the powerful. One of the most elegant ways to take advantage of the new tight networking among consumers is to identify the powerful members of a hive and make it as easy as possible for them to tell each other about an idea virus. When online content sites first debuted, they were extremely hesitant about sharing their articles. Some of them went so far as to make it impossible to copy and paste the text in an article. They were petrified that one person would copy an article and no one else would come to the site and see the ads. What they soon learned, however, was that the easier they made it to share, the more likely people were to tell their friends. And if someone came in to read one article, they were likely to read more. ZDNet.com was one of the first sites I encountered that used this technique. In one promotion my former company YoYoDyne did for them, they found that more than 20% of the people exposed to a compelling piece of content actually forwarded it to a friend. Fast Company magazine, devoted to bootstrapping startups, does the same thing. Visit www.fastcompany.com/team/wtaylor.html and you can see a list of the articles that co-founder Bill Taylor has written for that magazine. They're all there, unabridged, and you can read them for free. But the smooth part of this wannabe idea virus is the little button on the bottom that says, click here to send this page to a friend. All you have to do is type in your friend's email address and your email address, and boom, it's done. If his articles contain ideas that are virus-worthy, the Fast Company site is doing a good job in helping them go viral. 4. Digitally augment word of mouth. This is a really interesting way of looking at the fundamental change that's occurring and understanding how word of mouth is different from an idea virus. If I was delighted by a movie in the old days, I'd tell a friend or two. My comments would end up influencing 3 or 4 or 6 people. There are plenty of books on this topic, and marketers have always been enamored by the potential of word of mouth. Alas, without amplification, it usually peters out. Today, if I like a movie, I can post my comments on a variety of online movie sites, or I can email 10 friends, who can each forward the mail to 10 friends. Later, when the video comes out, I can post my review on Amazon, where hundreds or thousands of people might read it. Using a service like opinions.com, I can go online and search out opinions on everything from BMW motorcycles to summer camps. What's neat about digital word of mouth, let's call it word of mouse, is 1. It is extremely persistent. Unlike a comment at the water cooler or over the phone, a comment in a newsgroup on opinions or Amazon lasts forever. 2. It has much greater velocity. The number of ripples my stone makes when dropped in the pond of public opinion is far greater online. Why? Because if I tell you I like my car, it might be months before that sort of car comes up again in conversation. But online, conversations are happening 24 hours a day, and the conversation on any given web page is precisely about what that page is about. As a result, the number of interactions multiplies geometrically. 3. It can have more credibility. At first, the opposite was true. An anonymous stock tip or other form of online recommendation was totally suspect. The sneezer could be a paid mole, or worse, someone with horrible taste. But now, thanks to rating systems and the presence of powerful sneezers, it's possible to know how congruent your tastes are with those of the sneezer. So it ends up having a ton of credibility. Now, for the 5th and last of our 5 ways to unleash an idea virus, altruism. Several years ago, a hot chef in Chicago decided to go out on his own and open his first restaurant. Realizing how competitive the market was, he did a neat thing. He never opened it to the public. He refused to accept reservations from strangers. If you wanted to get into Les Nomades, you had to be a member. And how did you do that? Well, the first 500 people were given memberships because the chef knew them as regular customers at his old job, and he personally invited them. Then he told each member that they were welcome to sponsor other members. All they had to do was vouch for someone, and he'd make them a member too. So what's in it for the member to nominate someone else? Simple. They scored points with their friends as powerful sneezers because they could get you in to the hottest restaurant in town. Of course, this wouldn't have worked if the restaurant hadn't been spectacular. But it was, and it was exclusive. But by allowing his members to do his marketing for him, by giving them an altruistic tool that increased their power as professional sneezers, the chef was able to get out of the way and let his customers sell for him. Time now for some advanced riffs on the 8 variables you can tweak in building your virus. We're going to take a look at each of the 8 underlying variables in the idea virus formula and try to get a handle on exactly how you can manipulate them for your product. No two industries rely on the 8 fundamental principles in precisely the same way, but virtually every idea virus I've ever seen uses some of these principles in an extraordinary way, and just about every one could be improved if it expanded further into the other areas. We've defined all 8 of these terms in this program. Here they are. 1. Sneezers. 2. Hive. 3. Velocity. 4. Vector. 5. Medium. 6. Smoothness. 7. Persistence. And 8. Amplifier. First, sneezers. As described earlier, there are 2 kinds of sneezers, powerful and promiscuous. While all 8 elements of the formula are critical, this is the area where many brand marketers have the most control and thus the most influence. Choose your sneezers Don't let them choose you. By focusing obsessively on who you're choosing to sneeze on your behalf, you build the foundation for your virus. Powerful sneezers are certainly the most seductive in that the right word from the right sneezer can make all the difference to your virus. If David Letterman visits your diner on television, or The New Yorker writes a 20-page rave on your website, or if you win a MacArthur Fellowship grant, well, you've really made it. Oprah Winfrey is quite possibly the most successful sneezer of our generation. She has single-handedly turned more than a dozen books into national bestsellers. She has launched a magazine that already has more than 500,000 subscribers. She can influence millions of the most powerful consumers in America just by uttering a few sentences. It's interesting to see how effectively Oprah and her brandmate Martha Stewart have successfully monetized their position as powerful sneezers. If they trip and get perceived as promiscuous sneezers, as sneezers for hire, their effectiveness is quite reduced. But if they can maintain their position at the same time they sell books and magazines or sheets and towels, they've effectively leveraged their fame. But few of us are that lucky. Most times, you're going to have to focus on powerful but less influential sneezers. Individuals or organizations that have something to gain by endorsing your idea, but aren't so out there that they're tagged as promiscuous sneezers. Some powerful sneezers are very prominent and thus very hard to reach. The challenge for most marketers is to find the second tier of sneezer, the approachable, interested sneezer who can do almost as much for you as Oprah or Martha, but with whom you have a far greater chance of making an impact. The story of the Bridges of Madison County is a great example of this. Warner Books, the publisher, realized that most other publishers were doing very little to market to the independent bookstores, and if they could court them and give them something to sell that made them feel special, it would translate into a bestseller. Of course, as soon as the legions of independent booksellers succeeded in turning Bridges into a phenomenon, they were assaulted by dozens of other less imaginative publishers, all trying to rush in and use the same strategy. Too late. It got cluttered. They got busy. No one else ever repeated the focused, obvious success of this approach. Remember, an idea virus adores a vacuum, and the Bridges of Madison County filled that vacuum. As other book marketers rushed in, no one was able ever again to persuade a critical mass of booksellers to support just one book. Does this mean Warner Books was doomed never to be able to repeat this process again? Is that all there is? Just one gimmick after another? No! Instead, Warner needed to gain permission from this critical sneezer audience and use that permission to promote the next book and the next through a channel that they were clever enough to build. Now, let's look at Hive. Winning with an idea virus begins with the choice of Hive. And this choice is so important, I suggest the following. Choose your Hive first, then build the idea. Traditionally, marketers start with a problem or a factory and go from there. I've got a great widget, and now I need a way to take it to market. Or, we've got this excess plant capacity. Let's find a way to fill it. But that's not what works today. Choose your market by identifying a hive that has a problem and has the right concentration of sneezers, the right amplified networking, the right high velocity of communication, and most of all, an appropriate vacuum. Success will come to marketers who attack small but intimate hives. Yes, Yahoo and eBay hit huge home runs, but they're remarkable precisely because success across such a large hive is rare indeed. We can learn a more relevant lesson from magazines. Fast Company is one of the fastest growing and most profitable magazines ever. Why? Well, it certainly helps that it's a great magazine. It also helps that the internet created a huge demand for this sort of advertising space. But the real success came in the hive that the editors selected. It turns out there are hundreds of thousands of people in mid-sized to large companies who are eager to do a great job, but feel frustrated at the slow pace and mind-numbing bureaucracy they face every day. Until Fast Company, the members of this hive didn't even know there were others just like them. They didn't have a tool they could use to reach their peers. Fast Company became the identity, the Bible, the badge of honor for this new hive. It gave them a way to communicate, to learn, and to have confidence in themselves. By every measure, the magazine was virus-worthy. Just about every reader of Fast Company became a powerful sneezer. With no compensation and very little encouragement, they started signing up co-workers for subscriptions, Xeroxing page after page of the magazine, and passing around the office. The readers even created a worldwide network of support groups, meeting in cities on a monthly basis with no help at all from the magazine. Fast Company filled a vacuum. It got viral. It enchanted and connected with a huge legion of powerful sneezers, all because the editors chose the right hive and created a virus-worthy product. Selecting a hive that respects the core value of your virus is a critical first step in laying the foundation for promoting the idea. College students want something different from gardeners, who are quite different from computer geeks. Targeting everyone is a sure path to failure. Of course, the real reason you want to pick the right hive is not because their values match the benefits of your product. It's because when you pick the right hive, and a small enough hive, you have a chance of overwhelming it, of pumping so much positive juice into your digital word of mouth that you really do dominate, that so many sneezers are recommending you to the rest of the hive that the majority surrenders and the entire hive converts. Once your idea starts coursing through a hive again and again and again, you'll have a piling on effect. People will want to be exposed to your idea just because everyone else in the hive they respect is already talking about it. The mistake that's so easy to make is to get greedy as you choose your hive, to say, this product is for everyone, or anyone can benefit from this idea. Well, there are 7 billion people on the planet, so it's unlikely your comment is correct. And even if it is, there's little chance that a virus would spread across a hive that big. Far better to pick smaller hives and conquer them a few at a time. Far better to identify consumers when they're grouped in bunches, at a trade show, say, or geographically, and then allow the concentrated essence of your virus to spread to other hives. Coors did this with beer years ago. You could only get Coors in Colorado. Then you could only get it west of the Mississippi. By concentrating their marketing dollars, they addressed a smaller hive. This enabled them to get a larger percentage of the hive to sample the product. This core group then had a smooth way to spread the word, and it quickly conquered one state after another. Without any effort from the Coors people, the virus spread to the East Coast. Coors fielded thousands of requests from disappointed drinkers who wanted to try this new beer they'd heard about, but couldn't. Coors dominated a hive. Then they went national to try to fulfill the demand created when their hive spread the word. Unfortunately, the new hive was so large, it turned out to be difficult to satisfy and dominate. Compare the powerful, nearly effortless spread of their idea with the challenges they face today. As a national brand in a stagnant market, growth by any method is hard to come by. They built their company on a unique virus, but they couldn't continue to grow their company the same way. Now, let's consider vector. Richard Dawkins, a brilliant evolutionary theorist, had his own word for the phenomenon I'm calling idea viruses: memes. He pointed out that a meme was like a living organism, surviving not in the real world, but in our world of ideas. Like a real organism, memes could live and die, and more important, they could evolve. Every time a meme is passed from person to person, it gets touched, changed, and sometimes improved. Once a meme has been passed around enough, it ceases to evolve as quickly and just becomes a building block for future memes. Pop singers are experts at stringing together memes and turning them into concise snapshots of our lives. Paul Simon is a favorite. Graceland, Kodachrome, the pop charts, you get the idea. One of the behaviors noticed by Dawkins and practiced by anyone who markets with idea viruses is that memes follow a vector. An idea doesn't spread evenly and nicely through a population. Instead, people are more likely to send it in one direction instead of another. At college, there was always someone who knew where the good parties were and which ones to avoid. In your town, there's someone who just seems to have the inside buzz on which restaurants are hot. On the internet, some people seem to be on the vector of the latest email joke, while others, even in the same company or the same clique, just don't seem to get touched as often. When you create an idea and lay the groundwork for it to become a virus, it pays to study the vector you'd like to follow. Why? Because there's plenty you can do to influence its vector, and the vector you choose will have a lot to do with who gets the virus. The vector controls the hives through which the idea flows. If you're on the net, for example, the barriers you erect will influence your vector. If your site needs shockwave and flash and a high bandwidth connection, you're not likely to vector straight into the heart of the AOL user universe, regardless of where you start. If your goal is to create a trading card mania among third graders, launching a series of cards available only at liquor stores isn't going to enhance the vector, even if you seed the virus by handing the cards out at the local elementary school. But this is about more than simple access. Remember, the goal is to market to people and then get out of the way. So an email joke, which almost anyone with a job in this country could access at home, at work, or at the library, will still find its vector. How? There are three factors. 1. Who it starts with. Often, the way we decide which direction to send an idea is based on where it came from. It's hard, for example, to bring home a joke from the office. Instead, we're more likely to send it straight back into the quadrant of life from which it came. 2. Who it resonates with. An idea has to have impact to be worth sharing at all. And we're much more likely to share that idea with someone whom we believe it will impact as well. After all, if we spread ideas that don't go viral, it hurts our reputation as powerful sneezers. This encompasses the idea of access. I'm not likely to spread an idea if the recipient doesn't have the energy or the technology or the resources to get engaged with it. And 3, what's easy? The medium drives the spread of ideas more than you might imagine. If I have to print something out, put it in an envelope, and mail it to someone, that virus is going to stop right here. That's why TV and the internet have proven to be such powerful media for the spread of viruses. They're easy. Now, let's revisit medium. The medium is probably the most overlooked part of idea virus planning and construction. It's so obvious, we often don't see it. In Japan, teenage schoolgirls started and built a craze to billion-dollar proportions. They continue to line up to use a special kind of photo booth. Here's how it works. You enter the photo booth, similar to the old Polaroid ones of our youth. Insert some coins, and it takes your picture. But instead of giving you 4 shots on a strip, it prints out 16 little tiny 1-square-inch images on stickers. Now, what are you going to do with 16 pictures of yourself on stickers? Obvious. Share them with your friends. As a result, every popular Japanese schoolgirl has an autograph book loaded with dozens or hundreds of these stickers. Sort of like your high school yearbook signing ceremony, but on steroids. A friend of mine, Sam Attenberg, developed and patented this technology in the States. And while it never became a full-fledged virus in the U.S., it did develop pockets of intense activity in certain hives. Some machines were turning $70 an hour in sticker business every hour on the hour for weeks at a time. In Japan, 2 companies dominate a multi-billion-dollar industry in sticker stations. So what's the medium? It's the person-to-person exchange of stickers. The medium is the key to the entire virus. Once the first person got the sheet of stickers, the only way she could use them was by sharing them with 15 friends. But in sharing them, in using the medium provided, she had to explain where she got them. Boom. Virus spreads. Now, let's talk about smoothness. The goal, of course, is to have an idea virus so smooth that once someone is exposed to it, they are instantly hooked. A virus so powerful that all it takes is 1 guitar lick on the radio, 1 phrase in a book review, 1 glimpse of a website, and you completely and totally get it. And not only do you get it, but you want it, now and forever. One of the talents of the great Steve Jobs is that he knows how to design Medusa-like products. While every Macintosh model has had flaws, some more than others, most of them have had a sexiness that has turned many consumers into instant converts. Macintosh owners upgrade far more often than most computer users for precisely this reason. We have to own that new flat panel display. We must have the new color of iBook. Vindigo is Medusa-like in the way the virus spreads so smoothly. It only takes one look at a friend's palm in order to get hooked, and one file beaming to get it forever. The Nextel phone has that power, and so, for some people, does Britney Spears. Alas, it's not going to happen for you. While you can aspire to make your product more Medusa-like, it's a mistake to spend all your time wishing for it to happen. The odds are long indeed, especially if your product is not groundbreaking. The longer it takes someone to get the basic concept behind your idea, the less Medusa-like it is. But often, that's a good thing. Real change and the profit that goes with it often comes from unsettling ideas that significantly alter the way people interact with each other and with your company. And those ideas aren't as smooth as some others. Which brings us to persistence. In our quest for a quick hit, or an easy way to start a business, or just to increase our power as sneezers, there's a real desire for a shallow virus, a joke, a gimmick, a neat new technology gee-gaw that won't be around tomorrow. Laser pointers are a fine example. I was in a meeting last month where the presenter used a laser pointer to highlight various things on his deathly boring PowerPoint slides. Unfortunately for me, not only was the presentation boring, but he kept aiming the laser at the TV monitor, which reflected this highly focused electromagnetic radiation right at my face, hitting me in the eye a few times. I finally got him to turn the thing off, but not without considerable struggle. Other than this unfortunate incident, I can't remember how many years ago it was that I saw someone actually using one of these pointers. What happened was that the pointer came out, and for a few early adopters, it felt marvelous. It touched a Jungian need in us, especially men, I think, to have a magic stick that could project our thoughts on the wall. Of course, the best place to use one was in a meeting of other nerds, and all the other nerds noticed the laser pointer, and a virus was spread. But after we all went out and bought laser pointers, we discovered that they weren't particularly useful. After all, how much information could one really have to present that we needed a high-tech device to point out the good stuff from the bad? So the lasers ended up in a drawer. In other words, the virus wasn't persistent. Those who resisted the initial temptation to rush out and buy a laser pointer stopped being exposed to them, and the virus died off. Compare this to the palm virus. Every day, somebody else marches into your office, declaring their undying love and devotion to their new pocket wonder. And unlike laser pointers, people who love them keep using them. They persist. So many people are using it so often that you're constantly reminded that unless you get one, you're a loser. It's the persistence of the palm, more than any other viral factor, that has led to its success. Next, consider the amplifier. Word of mouth by itself isn't enough. As discussed earlier, unamplified word of mouth dies off too soon to be much good to the average business. The goal of a marketer creating an idea virus is to create a system that allows the positive word of mouth to be amplified and the negative to be damped. This simple idea is behind the success of PlanetFeedback.com. It's impossible for me to understand why any business invited by Planet Feedback to participate would hesitate for even a moment before signing up. If a consumer has a complaint or a compliment about a company, she can go to Planet Feedback and turn it into a letter to the company. Then, with a click, she can have a copy of the email go to the relevant congressmen, media, and regulatory agencies. Another click can send a copy of the letter to the consumer's 10 closest friends and coworkers. Instant amplification. Now, if your company is the target of a complaint, which course of action makes sense? You could either proactively grab the opportunity to stamp out a negative virus, to turn the complainer from an angry reporter of bad news into a now satisfied witness of how much your company cares, or you could ignore them and hope they'll go away. Of course, they won't go away. They, and the people already infected, will continue to amplify the message. Planet Feedback is providing a great service to all parties involved. By taking previously invisible word of mouth and aggregating it, they're making it far easier for companies to understand the viruses that are being spread. and they're giving them an opportunity to do something about them. And yes, they are viruses, ideas that are running amok, being passed from person to person. At the same time, Planet Feedback gives consumers far more power and makes it easier for them to get attention. The Vindigo case study. One of the best examples of a company unleashing an idea virus is Vindigo. You can find them at www.vindigo.com, and you'll need a Palm or something compatible to use the software. Vindigo is a directory of restaurants, entertainment venues, and stores in major U.S. cities. You download it to your Palm and carry it with you. Tell it where you're standing, for example, the corner of Amsterdam and Broadway in New York City, and it will show you whatever sort of restaurant or fun you're looking for, sorted by distance from where you are, with ratings, for free. What a killer app! I need to tell everyone. This is why they invented handheld computers. It's so cool! But while that alone is grounds for this to become an idea virus, as described, it doesn't seem particularly smooth. After all, after a sneezer tells you about this cool software, you've got to remember the name. Is it Vindalo, Vindaloo, Indigo? Go home, type it in your browser, download it, synchronize it, etc. A disaster! There's no way it's going to work. Which is where the smooth part comes in. You see, right on the bottom, underneath the buttons for eating, shopping, and entertainment, is a button that says, Give. So when a sneezer is going on and on and on about how cool this is, you just take out your palm, they take out their palm, press the Give button, and 60 seconds later, the entire product is now on your palm. That's smooth. It's about as close to perfect smoothness as you can get. It goes beyond smooth. It's persistent. The next time you synchronize your Palm with your PC, it will automatically upload all the ratings you've put into the computer and get you an updated version. Instantly. The idea virus has stuck. Is it working? Well, the folks at Vindigo seeded just 100 sneezers with the original version of the program. Then they spent virtually nothing on advertising and waited to see if the virus would spread. It's now the fastest-growing application on the Palm. Note that this isn't viral marketing in the sense that Hotmail is. You can happily use Vindigo for months without mentioning its existence to a friend. Vindigo works really well, but it also happens to be optimized for spreading the idea virus. It's time for the final section of our program, which I will devote to some vitally important ideas. First, the money paradox. The sooner you ask for money, the less you're likely to make. The single biggest mistake idea merchants make is that they ask for money too soon. On one hand, you want to charge early and often so you don't waste time on people who are just looking and so you can maximize your income before your idea fades. Take the money and run is a cliche for a reason. But this strategy introduces friction into the system. Many marketers require people to pay the most when they know the least. For example, why don't movie studios run a day of free sneak previews to get the virus started, and then charge more once everyone wants to see the movie? Today, if you want to taste a new movie, you've got to pay $8 for the privilege. On the internet, dozens of new businesses have discovered how important this model is. A company called eFax offers a service that lets you get faxes delivered to your email box. They launched it as a totally free service. Why? Because it's scary enough to have to be one of the first people to try something as flaky as eliminating your fax machine. And it's even scarier to pay money for the privilege as well. So eFax had a plan. Get people hooked on a free system. Build an idea virus. Then upgrade people to a paid system that offers all sorts of extras. In essence, 1, fill the vacuum, 2, achieve lock-in, and 3, extract revenue. They can fill the vacuum by getting in first and furious and spreading the virus. They achieve lock-in by making it hard for people to switch to a competitor. What a hassle to keep changing your fax number. And finally, they can extract revenue by offering value-added services or selling advertising. In that order. Will eFax be guaranteed an easy upgrade path to paying customers? I have no idea. Some businesses, like email, will be stuck at free forever, thus making the whole journey hard to justify. eFax could offer free faxes with an 8-hour delay before you get them. But for $5 a month, you get the faxes instantly. So it's free for me to try out, free to spread, but profitable after lock-in is achieved. The challenge, of course, is to figure out which businesses have a payoff at the end. The challenge is also to be patient enough to wait to introduce the friction of charging at just the right moment. Watts Wacker catapulted his career by writing The 500-Year Delta. After the book came out, people started to hand it around to embrace his ideas. This led to larger audiences and a dramatic increase in bookings for speaking engagements. In a few months, I'm confident he made more in speaking fees than he had from royalties on the book. By letting the idea virus grow before trying to extract much profit, he was able to make more money in the end. In very transparent markets like the Internet, the fear is that all idea viruses will be so competitive that you'll never be able to extract money. That's why the race to fill the vacuum is so intense. If you can fill the vacuum aggressively and permanently, it is far easier to extract money. Now, a further thought about sneezers. When a sneezer is ready to spread your idea virus, what should he say? It sounds like a simple, almost silly question, but it goes to the core of how smooth you can make your virus. If you give sneezers easy-to-follow, effective instructions, they're likely to follow them because, after all, their goal is to spread the virus. On Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the producers insist that Regis Philbin repeat the catchphrase, "Is that your final answer?" almost to distraction. But now it's become a powerful, smooth tool for sneezers who want to spread the virus. I must have heard the phrase 50 times and read it in dozens of newspaper columns before I saw the show for the first time. By giving loyal watchers a 5-word catchphrase, the producers created, intentionally or not, a powerful shorthand for referencing the show. Hotmail did the same thing with the SIG file in the free email each person sent. Right there at the bottom of each email, with no additional work on the part of the sneezer, were specific instructions on how to get Hotmail. Buffalo Springfield and the Beatles did the same thing with some of their songs. It took just a few notes, an investment by the listener of seconds, not minutes, for them to expose their idea to a new listener. By working so hard on the first chords of the song, pop music producers, and Beethoven for that matter, made their products far smoother. It's easier to share the song when you can hum the riff. For most ideas, the web can be a powerful tool to help with this. What might a website for sneezers look like? The first touch, the first impression, and first visit must go beautifully. It's got to be fast. It should contain exactly what you've tested and discovered that most effectively captures the attention of the first-time visitor. You're in control in this moment, and you can make it work or not. The site should also be filled with tools that make it really easy for a visitor to become a sneezer. Get out of the way. Give the sneezer something to share. Do like Tom Peters at www.tompeters.com and include all your PowerPoint slides. Don't require registration or permission at this stage. Let them in. Sell them on the idea, then give them the free tools to help them share. Let me tell you why I love bestseller lists. Riding through the New York subway last year, I encountered a kid wearing what appeared to be a black stocking on his head. But along the hem were the words, "Tommy Hilfiger." It seemed like an odd affectation, and I let it go. A week later, I saw 4 more Tommy skullcaps. In the week after that, a dozen. If I were in search of genuine urban chic, I certainly would have bought one at that point, if only to protect my trademark bald head from the winter chill. The same thing happened with the VW Beetle. First there was one in my neighborhood, a yellow one, and then a few, and then a dozen. With all these reinforcements, I assumed that it was now a safe thing to consider and went to the dealer to have a look for myself. Online, the rules are very different. There is no physical world to bump into. Instead, and even better for the statistician in each of us, there are actual digital counters and accurate up-to-the-second bestseller lists. No guessing, no inferences, the real scoop. Amazon.com has a bestseller list with more than 1 million titles on it. Visit any title, and you can see where it stands compared to every single other title in the world. Wow! Now we instantly understand what's hot and what's not. MP3.com has done the same thing with music. As a track gets played more and more often, it moves up their digital bestseller list. And yes, Zipf's law works here too. The topmost tunes are downloaded far more often than those just below them. We use the same math when we look at the media metrics list of the most visited websites, or Variety's tally of the weekly box office numbers. Some people saw Titanic just because it seemed that everyone else was. Various organizations also track best-selling cars, best-selling vodka, and highest-paid executives. One of the best ways to facilitate adoption of your idea virus is to find a bestseller list that makes sense and then dominate it. If that's impossible, figure out how to create your own bestseller list and popularize that. This isn't just conjecture. A breakthrough paper by Stanford Business School professor Kirk Hansen demonstrated this in a really profound way. His team artificially boosted the bestseller status of files for download on the web. They downloaded one file over and over and over again, increasing the counter of how often it had been downloaded. The result? Heavily downloaded files got downloaded more often. Nothing was changed but the counter, but users were more interested in seeing the most popular files. Simple, but true. Want to launch a new drink using your company's shishi liqueur? Why not identify the right bar, frequented by powerful sneezers in the hive you're targeting? Then pay the bar to post a best-selling drinks list. Now, bribe enough folks to go in and buy themselves a drink. Soon, you'll see your drink climbing the best-selling drinks list, and this alone ought to be enough to get other, less easily bribed drinkers to give it a try. Of course, sampling doesn't always lead to the spreading of a virus, but without sampling, you've got no chance, do you? Now, consider bumper sticker marketing. Years ago, I was a walking parody of a high-tech yuppie. I worked as a poorly compensated marketer at a startup software company in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I drove a dented old Saab. I used a Macintosh. And on the back of my Saab, I proudly stuck a bumper sticker that read, "I'd rather be driving a Macintosh." This is an ancient form of idea virus marketing, of course. I used my car as an amplifier, exposing my message to hundreds or thousands of people. But even better, given the neighborhood I was driving in, I was focusing the message on an appropriate hive. And given the car I was driving, adding power to my sneezing. Think about it. If the bumper sticker had been on the back of a junker Chevy, rusting outside an abandoned farm in Oklahoma, you would have had a very different response to the message, no? The neatest thing about this technique is the way Apple converted the private, "What sort of computer do I use?" to the public, my proclamation of how happy I was to be a Mac user. There are countless opportunities for marketers to do precisely the same thing today, and not just on your bumper. Some marketers ride along with their product. The Ralph Lauren pony, for example, is advertising on the front of your shirt all day long. Others manage to make it a more political choice. Marlboro, for example, was one of the 10 largest marketers of imprinted clothing a few years ago. Picking the medium for your bumper sticker is important, but it's just as important to determine why someone is going to be willing to stick his neck out to promote your product. Personal pride is an excellent tactic. If people are willing to sneeze on your behalf because they're proud of you, your product, and their association with it, you're in. Now all you've got to do is give them a smooth way to spread the word. Crossing the chasm with an idea virus. In his brilliant book, Crossing the Chasm, Geoffrey Moore unleashed a powerful idea virus about how new businesses and new ideas get spread. Basically, there's a chasm in the product adoption cycle. Imagine for a second the classic bell curve. On the left are early adopters, the nerds who love new stuff, who want to get their hands on anything neat and potentially wonderful. On the right are the laggards, who still have trouble getting rid of their steam engine cars. The meat, the bulk, is obviously in the center. That's where the vast majority of us live, and where the combination of big audience and pretty decent pricing is most attractive to a marketer. In the old days, people believed that you could introduce a product to the early adopters, use the high profits from those sales to ramp up production and advertising, and then roll the product out to the masses. There's a problem with this view. There is a gap in the curve, a chasm. What happened? It turns out that people on the right side of the chasm aren't just lazier or less intellectually curious than the folks on the left of the chasm. it turns out that people on the right are fundamentally different from the folks on the left. How? Pre-chasm people want something cool. Post-chasm people want something that works. A nerd wants the latest personal digital assistant. An executive wants to keep her appointments straight. A cutting-edge information technology guy at Allstate wants a device that will use satellite technology to update claims instantly. The CEO at Nationwide just wants something that will reduce costs. A fashionista wants the latest haute couture outfit from Paris, regardless of how ridiculous it looks. The party girl wants something that'll get her a hot date next week. The foodie wants maple jalapeno corn cakes layered with creme fraiche and bourbon. The hungry person just wants something to eat. As you can see, focusing on the folks who will give you early feedback, be your initial sneezers, your first customers, and probably your startup's employees is a one-way ticket to doom. Their advice will help you make stuff that's expensive, heavy, hard to use, awkward, and difficult to understand. You'll be the darling of some well-respected sneezers, and then you'll fail. This is why many idea viruses start with plenty of powerful sneezers, but end up dying. It happened to Apple with the Newton. It happened to Microsoft with almost every product they've ever launched. Bill Gates is to the far, far left of the chasm. That's why it takes Microsoft to version 3 to build something that catches on. It happened to Reebok, and to Stephen Sondheim, and to Lou Reed. In every case, they indulged the pre-chasm audience and lost the big wins on the right. Of course, in some cases, like Microsoft, sheer staying power is able to force you over the chasm. The challenge in launching an idea virus is to understand who the pre-chasm sneezers are and using them, but not letting them use you. In other words, they're the ones who are most likely to embrace your new idea and talk about it. But if you don't get past them to the rest of the curve, you're doomed. Some viruses are just never going to cross the chasm. Try as they might, the computer nerds are having no luck at all getting normal people to start using Linux. And the guys who sell the hottest hot sauce in the world are just not going to find themselves on the table at TGI Fridays. But that's okay. It's okay because the idea merchants understand that the hive they're targeting is not everyone. They understand that if they choose the right hive, it's okay if it's small. It's okay if it's not everyone. The caveat, of course, is to match your expenses and your expectations to the size of the hive you've chosen. If you spend big on product development and marketing, figuring that you will get over the chasm, you better. The heart of viral marketing. Remember, viral marketing is a special case of the idea virus where the amplifier for the virus is built right into the product. And the hot spot for this wonderful self-propagating process is in communication products. 25 years ago, when I got my first real job, we had no voicemail, no web pages, no fax machine, no cell phones, no pagers, and no email. I sometimes wonder what we did all day. So why is there such rapid innovation in this field when, at the same time, we're still using precisely the same QWERTY keyboard found on the early typewriters and the same pink while-you-were-out message pads that came with the first phone? The answer is pretty simple. Each one of these devices, the telegraph, the telephone, the fax machine, Federal Express, cell phones, email, and so on, creates long-term profits for its inventor, but is spread at relatively low cost. And the reason they spread? Because of viral marketing. Communication products demand viral marketing because they're worthless without someone at the other end. Metcalfe's law tells us that the value of a network increases with the square of the number of people using it. So when there are 10 fax machines in the world, that's 25 times better than when there were just two. Once I buy a communications device, two things happen. First, I become a powerful sneezer, telling all my friends to buy one so I can send them stuff. And second, provided it's a tool that uses an existing channel, like FedEx or Hotmail, every time I send someone a message, it's selling the medium. The story of Post-it notes is so good, it ought to be apocryphal, but it's actually true. Nobody was buying them. 3M was going to cancel the whole program. Then the brand manager of the product persuaded the secretary of the chairman of 3M to send a case of Post-its to the secretaries of the chairman of the other 499 Fortune 500 companies. Suddenly, the most powerful sneezers in the most powerful companies in the country were sending around memos, all containing comments scrawled on Post-its. It took just a few months after that for it to become yet another successful business communication device, a classic idea virus. When I was in business school, a classmate spent a year working on a secret project he wouldn't tell anyone about. Turns out he was working to launch MCI Mail, the first commercial email system. It's a shame he couldn't tell anyone, because a bunch of us would have been happy to tell him what we knew even 20 years ago. An email system isn't going to work if there isn't anyone to send email to. MCI was charging about $100 to set you up and another $20 or so a month, plus usage for this new service. Big mistake. They inserted friction early in the process, ensuring that people would never try it, especially so early in the virus's life. My idea was that they give MCI Mail, plus a computer to send it with, to 50 people in each of the top 100 companies in a given industry. Free! Suddenly, that industry's leaders would be communicating with each other fast and frequently. It would change the culture of the company. The virus would spread. MCI would win. So what's the lesson? There are two. One, if you can somehow convert your idea into a virus that has to do with communication, it's much easier to make it go viral. The best sort of communication is an actual communication tool, like the fax machine or ICQ, but inventing words or new musical concepts or other ways people communicate goes a long way as well. And two, find the powerful sneezers and beg, cajole, or even bribe them to use your new tool. The Great Advertising Paradox. Imagine for a second that there was a machine your company could buy. Assume it costs anywhere from $1 million to $100 million. You're promised by the salesman that using this machine can transform your business, dramatically increase sales and profits, and turn your business into a success. Interested? What if the salesperson also tells you that companies who don't buy the machine have a hard time growing and often languish? And then she points out that one company, Procter & Gamble, spent more than $2 billion on machines just like this one last year. Interested? Oh, there's one caveat, actually two. The ongoing output of the machine can't be measured. You have almost no idea if it's working or not, and there's no guarantee. If it doesn't work, tough. Still interested? Well, after those caveats, there's just one more fact to mention. On average, the machine only works for about 1 out of every 10 companies that use it. 90% of the time, the machine fails to work. By now, you've probably figured out that I'm talking about advertising. Mass market advertising is one of the most puzzling success stories of our economy. Companies spend billions of dollars to interrupt people with ads they don't want about products they don't need. The ads rarely work. Ads that are created by less than competent ad agencies and clients almost never work. One day, I'd like to write a book about the worst ads ever run, but my fear is that it would be too long. Now, writing off all marketing expenditures because most of the time they don't work isn't the right answer either. Hence the paradox. You can't grow without it, but you often can't grow with it either. So, if advertising is such a crapshoot, such a dangerous venture, why do it? Because, for the last 100 years, the single best way to determine whether a company was going to get big or stay small was to look at its advertising. Time and time again, aggressive companies with great advertising, regardless of their industry, have managed to make the ads pay and to grow and to become profitable. So what changed? A few things. First, the clutter in the marketplace has finally made advertising even less effective. A threshold has been crossed, and with hundreds of TV channels, thousands of magazines, and literally millions of websites, there's just too much clutter to reliably interrupt people. Add to this the consumerization of business-to-business sales, with more ads directed at businesses than ever before, and the explosion of dot-com advertising, and it's easy to see that the game is fundamentally different. So what should we do about it? Consider the ironic situation that the new ad agency and consulting firm March 1st, Inc. finds itself in. According to the New York Times, March 1st wants to launch with a bang, so they've announced a $50 million advertising campaign designed to, quote, cut through the clutter, unquote, and to, quote, get the name out there to create strong brand awareness, unquote, according to Robert Bernard, their CEO. How are they going to do this? By buying full-page ads in newspapers and internet trade magazines, by running TV commercials during sporting events, and even running ads in lifestyle magazines. Now, be honest. If you're flipping through a magazine or surfing through channels on TV, and you come across an ad that is based on, quote, the human desire to be first, unquote, will you stop and pay attention? Will the slogan, quote, a new company for the new economy, unquote, make you sit up and take notice? Will you give up a few minutes of your precious time to read an ad about a company you've never heard of, which solves a problem you probably don't have? Not bloody likely. Surely there's a better way for this company to spend $50 million. Surely there's a more effective way to start a relationship with the 10,000 people who matter to them than interrupting millions of us over and over and over. Old-fashioned, handcrafted, fun-to-make, sort-of-fun-to-watch interruption advertising isn't going to disappear altogether. But it's just a matter of time before CEOs and investors start measuring their ever-increasing ad budgets with the same critical eye they use for every other insanely expensive investment they make. Permission, the missing ingredient. When Hotmail launched their free email service, they did almost everything right. They built a product that was worthy of an idea virus. They made it smooth. They built amplification right into the product. They approached the right people and started with just enough push to make the thing take off. But then they made a huge error. They forgot to get permission to follow up. They failed to ask their users, the folks who were infected by the virus, if it was okay to send them an anticipated, personal, and relevant email every week. They didn't build an asset. As a result, the Hotmail website has one and only one way to make money, by selling banner ads. And nobody clicks on banner ads when they're reading their email. So advertising on the Hotmail site is super cheap and probably overpriced. We're talking a multi-billion dollar mistake here. If they had permission to follow up with 20 million people every single week with an email that was filled with useful information and relevant ads, they could easily sell the slots in this email for a buck a week. That's $1 billion a year in lost revenue, which, using stock market multiples, is a gazillion dollars in market cap, all because they forgot to ask for permission. Let's face it, it's unlikely that every single idea you come up with is virus-worthy. If we're going to have to grow our businesses in a reliable, predictable way, it's unwieldy to have to depend on an idea virus catching on every time we want to grow. We still need a way to communicate with people directly, to do it when we want to talk to the marketplace without a filter. Advertising used to be the way to do this. But what a waste! What a waste to have to pay a magazine for an ad to reach a user you already have. You've got a pair of Nike sneakers in your closet, but Nike has to buy an ad to reach you. They don't have permission or the ability to talk to you directly. The challenge of the idea merchant is to turn the virus into an asset. And you turn the virus into an asset when you ask the user for permission to follow up directly. This is probably the biggest mistake that idea virus marketers have made to date. They launch a virus, a website, a book, a record, a software program, a food, and enjoy the fruits of the virus while it lasts, but fail to gain a long-term asset. And without that asset, they can't launch new products or leverage their existing ones without long lag times and the high costs associated with contacting the users they've already converted. How a virus and permission team up to find aliens. Turns out that the best way to find alien life somewhere in the universe is to listen. Specifically, to use powerful supercomputers to scan the spectrums for anomalous sounds. Unfortunately, there isn't a supercomputer available that's powerful enough to get the job done in our lifetime. Which is why the SETI built the largest distributed computer network in the world. More than 2 million computers are working in their spare time to process these huge hunks of data. The mechanics of the system are elegant. Whenever your computer has some downtime, a screensaver pops up, and behind the scenes, your Pentium processor starts cranking through data that the computer downloads through the web. But what's really neat is the fact that all 2 million computers in the network signed up without any advertising or financial inducement. Instead, the SETI project launched an idea virus. Word spread among nerds the world over that they could help find alien intelligence by having their computers participate in the network. It's a classic idea virus propagated by some powerful sneezers. The power of the network, though, comes from the fact that they don't have to relaunch the thing every week. That it's incredibly persistent, of course. Once you set it up, it stays set up until you take the initiative to turn it off. But even better, they have permission to communicate with their users. This permission is an asset. You can measure it. You can leverage it. You could turn it into cash if you wanted to. Let's take one more look at the sequence. 1. Invent a virus-worthy idea. 2. Make it smooth and persistent. 3. Incent powerful sneezers. 4. Get their permission to follow up. The art of creating an idea virus. So far, much of what we've discussed is science. Mathematical formulas, game theory, categories of individuals. This is stuff you have to do well to allow your virus to take hold. And as the understanding of propagating viruses increases, companies will get better and better at the tactics. The hard part, though, is building the virus in the first place. The hard part is inventing an idea that's so compelling, so wow, that it spreads through the hive with high velocity, converting everyone in its path. How is it that some ideas move so quickly, while others just languish? Why did the Apple Newton fail so badly, while the Palm took off just a few years later? Warning! If I knew the answer, I'm not sure I would tell you. To date, no one has come up with a repeatable formula for creating viruses in a reliable way. There are precious few people who are serial virus starters. My hope was that I could answer the big question about how. Alas, I don't know. I know it when I see it, but I fear the rest is art. Which means you win by trying and failing. Test, try, fail. Measure, evolve, repeat, persist. It's old-fashioned and hot and dusty and by no means guaranteed to work. Sigh. The future of the idea virus. What happens when everyone does it? Interruption marketing, the kind they do on TV, is doomed to fail because each marketer who enters the field has more to gain by adding to the clutter than they do by trying to make the medium work for everyone else. It's the classic Hudson River pollution problem. Once a big factory is polluting the river, you might as well too. Permission marketing, on the other hand, is self-limiting. When people have had enough, they'll just stop giving permission to marketers, and thus there will be no clutter crisis. Sure, some folks will cheat by spamming or invading privacy or buying and selling names. But societal pressure and a few key government regulations should stop the cheaters. But what about the idea virus? After it dawns on marketers that it's working, won't we all be flooded by offers to make us promiscuous and an incredible flow of free this and free that? You betcha. I think a few things will occur. 1. The race goes to the swift. Just as Frank Zappa and David Bowie supercharged their careers by getting on CD early, some marketers will fill vacuums and enjoy profits for years to come. Latecomers will get hurt. 2. The cost of spreading a virus will increase. The bounties to turn people promiscuous will increase. The benefit to powerful sneezers will increase. When there's huge demand for recommendations, marketers will have to pay more to get them. 3. There will be a significant benefit to becoming a powerful sneezer. Everyone will want to be Esther Dyson or Walter Cronkite, because that sort of genuine credential can be turned into a profit for years and years. Thus, we'll see fewer institutional efforts and more individuals, free agents, who figure out that they can profit mightily by spreading their own viruses. This manifesto is a living example of that technique. 4. It's going to be noisy and loud and cluttered as we transition, with a few huge winners and many satisfied marketers who dominate a hive but don't necessarily tip it. After that, once the various media settle down, an equilibrium will return and hopefully the good stuff will win. Good luck. Tell me how it goes for you.
Unleashing the Idea Virus was written and read by Seth Godin. Directed by Jan Werner. The recording engineer was Michael Jones. recorded at Corelli Jacobs in New York, with additional recording at Zone Recording in Cotati, California. Special thanks to Blair Hardin. Unleashing the Ideal Virus was abridged and produced by Jesse Barnes. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.